Wednesday, October 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. presidential candidates prepare to face off in their last televised debate. A new documentary explores how Muslim American candidates are seeking political office in the U.S.
They are all seeking the same thing. That's to represent this small but growing minority in the United States, the Muslim American community.
And we hear how a newly released country song is racing up the charts. It's all ahead. Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump meet in Las Vegas, Nevada, Wednesday for their third and final presidential debate. Trump continues to trail Clinton in public opinion polls, and Wednesday's debate may be his final opportunity to change the trajectory of the race with less than 3 weeks to go until Election Day. Donald Trump's rise to the Republican presidential nomination has been driven by what some are calling America's forgotten white working class poor. International Edition's Lori London spoke with J.D. Vance, author of the memoir Hillbilly Elegy, which is now number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list.
That group of people, whether they're relatively poor or whether they're lower middle income, have, in a lot of ways, I think, not done especially well. They haven't done especially well on a number of indicators, not just economically, but socially, the eviction epidemic, mortality rates, family dissolution, and so forth. And that's who the book is about. And if you look just at the sort of data, that's who Trump is especially popular among. It. If you look at his base of support, it's white voters without a college education in these areas of the country. So I guess it's somewhat fortunate for the book's success, at least, that Trump came along now. And obviously a lot of people are asking questions about the people who are voting for him.
And you are someone who lived through that type of upbringing. Why would you say this group of people gravitate to him the way they have?
Well, I think that there are a couple of things going on. First of all, I think the tone that Trump conducts himself with, how unfiltered he is, he's sort of loud and boisterous and occasionally funny, it reminds people of the way that they may talk about politics around the dinner table. So there's something very relatable in the tone and the way that he conducts himself. He's not filtered. He doesn't sound like everything he says is poll tested, a consultant approved. And so a lot of people like that. I think there's also a substantive reason that people are voting for him, which is that, you know, things have not gone especially well in these areas. You know, whether you're talking about the decline of manufacturing jobs, the difficulty of finding a good wage, the housing crisis, the addiction crisis, rising mortality rates, there are a number of those different indicators that suggest that people in this area are not doing especially well, and they've long been frustrated by the political elites of both parties who they feel aren't doing anything to make it better. So along comes Donald Trump, and he runs not just against the Democratic elites, but also the Republican elites. And that's been a breath of fresh air for people who feel ignored and frustrated.
His life isn't remotely like theirs. Why are they so willing to trust that he will care?
You know, there are a couple of responses. One, I don't think that everybody thinks that he necessarily will care. You know, a lot of the people I know who are voting for Donald Trump, they don't necessarily love Donald Trump. They just dislike Hillary Clinton, and they disliked his Republican challengers before him. So it's not so much a pro-Trump vote as it is a rejection of the alternatives, which in a lot of people's eyes have been pretty bad. The second thing I'll say is that there's something very important, not just about your personal background if you're a political candidate, but also about the tone that you bring to political conversations. So think about Bill Clinton, who was very, very popular among the white working class. He was, of course, a Yale-educated, pretty elite guy, but he downplayed all of that. He didn't play up his wealth and his you know, his fame, his elite credentials. If you think about the way that Donald Trump talks to voters, he talks about caring about the uneducated, he talks about caring about the construction worker or the coal miner. There's something to be said just for talking and getting yourself in front of a crowd and speaking to the crowd in a way that relates to them, even if you yourself aren't totally relatable.
The wounds are pretty deep in this country when it comes to race and class.
That's certainly true. There are a lot of people who feel justifiably so that they've been ignored in one way or the other, either because, you know, they're black and political elites don't care about their problems, or maybe because they're white working class and people don't care about their problems. I don't think that our political class has done a very good job at addressing the concerns of a lot of these voters. And so it's unsurprising that we have a couple of political movements right now in this country that are pretty frustrated and angry, and for the first time in a while are making their voices heard.
We talked about this group of people. Many of them are diehard supporters of Donald Trump. He even once said, we've all heard, that he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and they wouldn't care. They would still support him. And recently there have been a lot of allegations regarding sexual misconduct, and they're still supporting him and they don't believe it. And it almost seems like to them he's like their messiah.
Well, yeah, I mean, so again, I sort of restate the point I made earlier, which is that it's not so much about how much people love Donald Trump as much as it is about how much they hate the alternatives. That's sort of point one. The second point is that the issue with a lot of the criticism that's been levied against Donald Trump, or a lot of the accusations that have been levied against Donald Trump, and I say this as someone who believes these accusations and thinks that he's a pretty disgusting person, is that they're coming from the same sources that have really lost credibility among the white working class. You know, Donald Trump loves to make fun of CNN, and people get excited and they cheer when he makes fun of CNN because mm-hmm. they themselves see CNN as a sort of representative of a media establishment that isn't telling the truth and doesn't ultimately care about their concerns. So the issue here, to me, is not so much a loyalty to Donald Trump. It's a deep, deep mistrust of many of the institutions of our society, in this specific case, the media. I don't think that is going to go away even when Donald Trump loses. That mistrust of the media, the unwillingness to believe things that the media tells you, it's not going to go away. And I think that's driving this, again, more than any special love for Donald Trump.
That's author J.D. Vance. He's the author of the book Hillbilly Elegy, and he spoke with International Edition's Lori London. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. And Andrew, I can only imagine what social media is saying as we are preparing, we're getting ready for this big debate tonight.
Well, it's apropos of that story about a lot of that anger that we're seeing, a report from the New York Times showing a spike in anti-Semitic posts on Twitter. They say correlating with the election and a lot of it coming from Trump supporters. A lot of people on social media very fearful about this report, very fearful of those comments, saying it's taking the country in a very dangerous direction. Now, this isn't the first time that religion has been part of the campaign. A lot of Trump supporters on social media pointing out that as part of the WikiLeaks email release, there were some emails from Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta showing some potentially anti-Catholic thoughts, or at least some questionable comments about Catholics. So they're saying, well, you know what, if there's anti-Semitism being alleged against the Trump supporters, there's anti-Catholicism or anti-religious bias against Hillary Clinton's people as well. So again, it's, you know, they always say the two things you don't talk about are politics and religion.
Yeah.
Well, this includes both in this story. But let's move on to something, you know, a little lighter. Even though President Obama is heading out of office, they had President Obama, his last state dinner last night for the Italian Prime Minister, Matteo Renzi. And the big story out of this state dinner was Michelle Obama's $12,000 Versace dress, this stunning, glowing, kind of golden dress. People raving about it on social media, saying how glamorous she looked, hoping that whoever the next president is, that they'll bring some kind of glamour like that to the White House. Many people doubting that they will be able to, either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. So they're saying they're going to miss Michelle Obama. And a lot of people using this opportunity to pick out some of her favorite looks and favorite state dinner dresses. She has been stunning at many of these state dinners. And a lot of people noting how stylish she is as President Obama's term comes to an end.
Yes, she certainly has been over the years.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The international charity Save the Children says thousands of people have fled Mosul in order to escape the unfolding offensive by Iraqi and Kurdish forces to retake the city. In addition, the United Nations declares Russia's truce extension in Aleppo inadequate. Pakistani broadcasters are banned from airing Indian content. And Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has told 21 Chibok girls rescued that he will redouble efforts to find those still missing. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
3, 2, 1.
An Antares rocket carrying a Cygnus spacecraft was successfully sent into space on October 17th from NASA's Wallops Island Flight Facility in Virginia. The last attempt to launch a resupply mission from the launch site on October 28, 2014, ended with an explosion and fire just 6 seconds after liftoff. Cygnus is carrying food, supplies, provisions, and emergency equipment for the ISS crew, as well as a couple of science experiments. NASA says the cargo ship is scheduled to arrive at the space station several days after launch. Once the supplies are unloaded, ISS crew members will pack the spacecraft with garbage for disposal. According to NASA, as the spacecraft is sent back to Earth in mid-November, the craft and its load of garbage will burn up as it re-enters the atmosphere. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, three famous country music songs are combined into one new recording. Muslim Americans are becoming a new force in U.S. politics. Muslim immigrants are also competing for political office. VOA Midwest correspondent Kane Faraba has completed a television documentary on the subject, where he looks at four contenders for government offices in the states of Minnesota, Michigan, Nevada, and Illinois. The four are from Somalia, Yemen, Jordan, and India. Kane tells me about his documentary, Faith in Freedom.
They are all seeking the same thing. That's to represent this small but growing minority in the United States, the Muslim American community.
Well, now, two of those states you mentioned, I know, have large Muslim populations. Minnesota, there's a large Somali population
right there,
and also Michigan around the Detroit area, I believe.
Right. The candidate that we follow in Minnesota is Ilhan Omar. She is the first Muslim American immigrant woman to seek political office in the United States, and she's poised to make history with her candidacy. The interesting thing about her is that she's running for an open state legislature seat in the Minneapolis area. It's a very liberal district she's seeking to represent. It includes many of the Somali American diaspora, but the reality is she did not win the Somali American vote in her election. She actually lost the Somali American vote to another candidate in that race, another Somali American man. He received the most number of Somali American votes, but she actually won her race because she had a wide range of support among voters that were outside the Somali diaspora.
Well, has she faced controversy being a woman and wanting to be involved in politics?
Not so much controversy, but it has been a factor for people specifically in the Somali community who do vote to support her. I mean, you know, it's a very male-dominated culture, and so it played a role in her race, but she actually found out how to appeal to a broad group of voters, and that's how she was successful in her election.
When you look at the election going on now, and of course we read headlines around the world of Islamic militancy, you know, how have some of these politicians, I mean, I'm sure some voters have asked some questions about how they feel about some of this.
So in the race that I followed in Nevada, Jesse Spey, he's a Jordanian immigrant. He's a Muslim American lawyer. And he is fairly well known in the Henderson, Nevada community. And his candidacy for this congressional seat, he was running in the Democratic primary, was happening at a time when a lot of terrorism events were unfolding around the world. And so you'll see in the piece, the struggle for him was how to respond to this, being a Muslim American and being a Muslim American candidate. In talking with his campaign manager, she said one of the frustrations was that she wishes he could have just simply responded as a human, you know, just responded to these things without being a Muslim American. But unfortunately for him, this was added weight to however he was going to make a response to those things. And of course, what was happening and his response to that was that this does not represent what the faith is about, and that it shouldn't represent what he thinks or what he feels.
You mentioned another politician you followed who's from Michigan. Could you tell me a bit about that candidate?
Saad al-Masmari is an immigrant from Yemen and became a U.S. citizen a number of years ago. And his town is Hamtramck, Michigan, which for the longest time has been a town made up mostly of Polish immigrants who have kind of come to define this part of the state. They were all working, many people who lived there were working in the auto industry. But as the auto industry jobs went away, the Polish immigrants left or migrated to other suburbs. So now Hamtramck is filled with Bosnian immigrants, Yemeni immigrants, immigrants from many other Muslim countries. And so they make up a large portion of the population of Hamtramck. Last fall, in city council elections, Hamtramck became the first Muslim-majority city council in the United States. Four of the seven council members are Muslim Americans. Saad al-Masmari, in this election, won the most number of votes in that election, which helped bring this to the Muslim-American majority of council members. And this was at the time in which Donald Trump was calling for a ban on Muslims coming into the United States. And so his race had some prominence because it coincided with these issues on the campaign trail. And so there was a point, and I asked Saad al-Masmari, you know, have you had any contact with people? And another reporter had asked him, if he could tell Mr. Trump anything, what would you tell him? And apparently he says that Donald Trump's campaign reached out to him to see if he had 15 or 20 minutes to meet with Mr. Trump. And Saad al-Masmari said that he's just too busy focusing on what was important in Hamtramck that he didn't have time to meet with Trump.
All right. Well, sounds like a fascinating documentary. Thanks very much, Kane.
Thanks for letting me talk to you about it.
That's VOA Midwest correspondent Kane Faraba discussing his new documentary, Faith in Freedom, The Journey of Muslim American Candidates. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. The Country Music Association, one of the most influential ambassadors of country music, turns 50 this year. To honor this milestone, the CMA brought a one-time gathering of 30 artists to record a new song that's already making history. Nikki Strong of VOA One joins me with the details.
It's called Forever Country. It's a mashup of three iconic country songs, John Denver's Take Me Home, Country Roads, Willie Nelson's On the Road Again, and Dolly Parton's I Will Always Love You. It was recorded in 3 days in Nashville in June with Shane McAnally as the producer.
So how did they choose these three songs?
Well, it's a combination of things. Originally, it was just going to be a song along with a video. But as they were brainstorming, they decided to ask Joseph Kahn, who is the Grammy Award-winning director of Taylor Swift's Bad Blood video, since he was going to direct the video. They said, you know, they asked him, were there any country songs that he would like to do? And after some thought, he was like, you know what? One song really won't capture the rich history of country music, so why don't we do a mashup of, like, three songs? And that is when the awesome producer Shane McAnally was brought in to make that happen, especially since he is also on the CMA board.
Well, that's a big task to undertake.
Yes, it is. He was scared at first, understandably, despite how talented he is. He considered 40 songs, 40 of them. And, you know, one of his concerns was that country songs have narratives. And so he didn't want to take snippets of songs and then undermine the narrative of each song. He wanted to do each song justice, as well as do the overall mashup justice. The songs he considered were previous CMA Song of the Year winners, or at least were nominated, and had, like, universal themes that could sound like a love song to the country genre. So these three wound up making it, to make a long story short, and I personally think he did a fantastic job. And I'm not the only one. The song debuted in the number one spot on the Billboard Hot Country Singles chart. It's the third ever to do so, and that also enables each artist that is on that song have a number one hit on the charts as well.
Oh, fabulous.
Yes.
So how did they choose the artists?
Okay, so at first they didn't know how many artists were going to participate and decided to narrow down the list by considering only previous CMA winners. So they wanted artists of then, now, and forever, as they called it. So they reached out to many, and about 30 were able to do it. And the list includes Dolly Parton, Miranda Lambert, Alabama, Charlie Pride, Luke Bryan, Willie Nelson, to name a few. The song is great, as I said, as well as the video that goes along with it. And also all the profits from the sale and streaming of the song go towards music education sponsored, supported by the CMA Foundation.
Well, you can hear Forever Country by artists of then, now, and forever on VOA One's Country Hits with Nikki Strong. You can also see the video on Facebook and Twitter at VOA One The Hits. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
You're welcome.
And that is the new recording, Forever Country. Well, that's our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at a Nigerian-American Chamber of Commerce conference on small and medium-sized enterprises, or SME, financing and franchising in Abuja, Nigeria, on October 5th, U.S. Chargé d'Affaires David Young said the United States has provided more than $500 million in annual assistance to Nigeria in the areas of health and security, but is also increasingly focused on the issues of economic stability and growth for the country. We recognize that our shared health and security goals depend on a prosperous economy, he stated. Mr. Young recalled that at the U.S.-Africa Business Forum in New York, President Barack Obama said, "Wherever I've gone, from Senegal to South Africa, Africans insist they don't just want aid, they want trade. They want partners, not patrons. They want to do business and grow business, and the United States is determined to be that partner for the long term." Mr. Young highlighted the United States' support for Africa's economic prosperity under President Obama, including renewal of the 10-year extension by Congress of the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, in 2015 for a decade. Other important steps taken by the United States: launching Trade Africa and Power Africa, creating the Doing Business in Africa campaign, and increasing commitments from the U.S. Export-Import Bank, Overseas Private Investment Corporation, and the Millennium Challenge Corporation. The 2016 Nigerian-American SME Financial and Franchising Conference is a bilateral trade and investment advancement initiative organized in collaboration with the Economic Section of the United States Embassy in Nigeria. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Nigeria, to promote a vibrant economy for the benefit of all Nigerians, the region, and the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage.
www.voanews.com/editorials.